fucking head. The twins join Steven's cleanup parade without too much objection, and Sonia and I are left at the table. "You all right, darling?" I say. Then I place a hand to her forehead. A moment ago, my girl was sweating like a gin and tonic forgotten on a porch in July. Now she's settled down a bit. Not sweating, but far from a cool cucumber. This is the worst of all of it. This, right now, watching Sonia track Steven, watching her grow more calm with every step he takes toward the kitchen. It's the worst, because now I know what Sonia is really afraid of. I don't speak, only cock my head toward the place where Steven is rinsing bits of ground beef and potato off plates, humming some old tune. And she nods. Steven was 11 when his only sister arrived, almost old enough to be a father himself, if only in the biological sense. He had a way with her, kept her distracted and happy, changed the crappy diapers without more than a, "Hey, Mom, this is some crappy nappy." Few tweens learn baby sign language, but my eldest son was one of them. By barely older than a year, Sonia had the signs for her entire world down. Eat, drink, sleep, dolly, and, her all-time favorite, go poo. Steven dubbed this particular gesture, often accompanied by the spoken words, a translation of some primitive language, a system so arcane that no one, not even Dr. Jean McClellan, would be able to piece it together. He launched into a tune so grotesquely bastardized I didn't know what to think. Patrick nearly spilled his morning coffee at the sound of Steven singing. There were the police, and their do-do-do-da-da-da, or however it goes. There was that Lou Reed piece about how the colored girls sing do-do-do. Ultra-racist now, but it was Lou Reed, and he could get away with all kinds of shit back then. There were those Motown bands, and those white people who wanted to sound like they were a Motown band, and there was every other songwriter in the modern world who stumbled over a lyric and ended up filling the space with something that rhymed with the kiddie word for defecation. And finally, there was my own son crooning along to the entire musical canon from Brahms to Beyoncé, replacing each and every word with poo. The memories make the present doubly hard, but finally, I say it. "Did Steven come to your school today?" A nod. "Do you want to tell me about it?" No, she does not. "Story then?" I say. I let her go off to her bedroom, my lackluster reminder to brush her teeth following her from the dining table, down the hall, to the bathroom she has for herself now that the twins are of that age when separate peeing quarters become important. Patrick's door doesn't so much as squeak on its hinges when Sonia runs by it. I take everything out on Steven. Maybe this isn't the best parenting tactic, but I'm furious. "What happened at Sonia's school today, Steven?" I say, after sending Sam and Leo off to the TV room. They're eager to go, mostly because, without their older brother, they get a few minutes alone with the remote. Steven shrugs, but doesn't turn from the sink. "I'd like an answer, kiddo," I say, and I press his shoulder, forcing him to turn. It's only now that I see the small pin on his collar, about a pinky's worth wide. Inside the silver circle, on a white field, is the single letter P in bright blue. I've seen this before. The first time, it was on television during that ridiculous segment where three Bible-thumping women in twin sets tore Jackie Juarez to shreds. Not a week later, I saw it decorating one of Olivia King's church dresses when she knocked on my door asking if I had an egg to spare. It's supposed to be a symbol of solidarity, I guess, this quiet blue P worn by both men and women now. Olivia's daughter Julia has one, and sometimes I've seen it when I've been at the grocery store or at the dry cleaners picking up Patrick's shirts. I ran into Dr. Claudia, my former gynecologist, in the post office, and even she had one, although I suspected her husband had more to do with Claudia's choice of accessories than she herself did. I know the P stands for pure. Pure man, pure woman, pure child. What I don't know is why my own son is wearing this pin. "When did you start this?" I say, fingering his collar. Stephen brushes my hand off as if it's an annoying fly and returns to rinsing plates and loading the dishwasher.
Got it the other day. No big deal.
Got it? As in what? It fell from the sky? You found it in a storm drain? No answer. You don't just get these, Stephen. He shoulders past me, pours himself a glass of milk from the fridge, and downs it.
Of course you don't just get them, Mom. You have to earn them.
I see. And how does that happen? Another glass of milk disappears down Stephen's gullet. Save some for cereal tomorrow, I say. You're not the only human in this house.
Maybe you should go out and get another carton, then. It's your job, right?
My hand flies with a will of its own, makes contact, and a bright palm print blooms on the right side of Stephen's face. He doesn't flinch, doesn't raise his own hand, doesn't react at all, except to say,
"Nice, Mom. Real nice. One day, that's gonna be a crime."
You little shit. He's smug now, which makes everything worse.
I'll tell you how I earned the pin. I got recruited.
Recruited, Mom. They needed volunteers from the boys' school to make the rounds to the girls' schools and explain a few things. I accepted. And for the past 3 days, I've been going out in the field and demonstrating how the bracelets work. Look. He pushes up one sleeve and brandishes the burn mark around his wrist.
We go in pairs and we take turns. All so girls like Sonia know what will happen.
As if to defy me once more, he drains his glass of milk and licks his lips.
By the way, I wouldn't encourage her to pick the sign language back up.
Why the hell not? I'm still trying to absorb the fact that my son has purposefully shocked himself, quote, so girls like Sonia know what will happen.
Mom, honestly, you of all people should get it.
His voice has taken on the timbre of someone much older, someone tired of explaining how things are.
Signing defeats the purpose of what we're trying to do here.
Of course it does.
Look, I can't tell you the details, but there are people researching the new, you know, devices. They'll be more like gloves. Really, that's all I should say.
He straightens, smiling.
Except that I've volunteered to beta test them.
You what? It's called leadership, Mom, and it's what pure men do. I don't know what to say, so I say the first thing that comes to mind.
You goddamned bastard.
Stephen shrugs.
Whatevs.
Then he stalks out of the kitchen, leaving the glass on the counter next to a note saying, "Buy milk." Sam and Leo are in the kitchen doorway, staring at me. So I don't dare cry. 16. After I read Sonia her bedtime story and lie next to her, waiting for the steady breathing that tells me she's asleep, I go to my bedroom. Our bedroom. Tonight, I have it all to myself because Patrick is still in his study, even though it's approaching midnight. Rarely does he stay up so late. Tonight, I think about men. When I put the twins to bed, Stephen was in the TV room, eating ice cream and watching part of a series of talks by Reverend Carl, who I now believe might be my son's hero. The two of them make a pair, both so steadfast in their ideas of reversion to a former time, an age when men were men and women were women and glory, glory, fucking hallelujah, things were so much easier back when we all knew our places. I can't hate Stephen because he believes in something so wrong, even if I hate what he believes. Other men, though, are different. Not long after Sonia's 5th birthday, after we were fitted with the counters, I phoned my doctor at home, ready with a precisely worded set of questions, a pigeon of sorts. I pared the phrases down, eliminating copulas and modifiers, getting to the meat as quickly as possible. The recorder would pick up every word. Even a whisper. Who knows what I expected from her, what my doctor of more than 10 years could tell me. Maybe I wanted a partner in silence. Maybe I only wanted to hear how pissed off she was. Dr. Claudia answered, listened, and a low moan escaped before her husband came on the line.
"Whose fault do you think it was?" he said. I stood in my kitchen, wanting to explain, careful not to, while he told me we'd marched one too many times, written one too many letters, screamed one too many words.
"You women, you need to be taught a lesson," he said, and hung up.
I didn't call her again to ask how they had silenced her, whether they had stormed into her practice or whether they had invaded her kitchen, if they had loaded her into a van along with her daughters and spelled out the future inside a dim gray room before fixing shiny wristbands on each of them and sending them home to cook and clean and be supportive, pure women, to learn our lesson. Dr. Claudia would never have put on that collar pin, not without a fight, but I know she's still wearing it. Probably her daughters are too, like Julia King next door. I knew Julia when she wore cut-off jeans and halter tops, when she raced her bike down the street with an MP3 player on full volume, singing along to the Dixie Chicks, when she caught me in the garden and told me another story about how weird her mother was acting, rolling her eyes at the ridiculousness of all that pure crap. When her father caught her talking to me, I guess it was about a year and a half ago now, he took Julia by the arm and shuttled her through the screen back door. I still remember what her crying sounded like when Evan beat her. Patrick's study door squeaks open, and his footsteps move down the hall, away from our bedroom, toward the kitchen. I could go to him, pour us a stiff drink, and tell him what happened with Stephen after dinner. I should go. I know it. But I won't. Patrick is the third type of man. He's not a believer, and he's not a woman-hating asshole. He's just weak. And I'd rather think about men who aren't. So tonight, when Patrick finally comes to bed, even after he apologizes, I decide to dream of Lorenzo again. I never know what brings it on, what makes me imagine it's his arm and not my husband's curled around my waist during the night. I haven't spoken to Lorenzo since my last day at the university. Well, and that one other time, afterward, which didn't involve an abundance of vocalization. I wriggle out from the heavy appendage encircling me. It's too much like ownership, that gesture, too possessive. Also, the smoothness of Patrick's skin, his soft doctor's hand and fine hair, they're all getting in the way of my memories, blotting them out. Lorenzo may have returned to Italy by now. I'm not sure. It's been 2 months since I followed my heart and libido and went with him. 2 months since I risked everything for an afternoon tumble. Not tumble, Jean. Love, I remind myself. It was his plan all along to go back to what we called the boot once the visiting professorship had run its course. He missed the cooking and the sea. Oranges and peaches fattened on rich volcanic soil until they grew as big as the sun. And his language. Our language. Patrick stirs beside me, and I slip out of bed. In the kitchen, I get out the old macchinetta from a cupboard, press espresso grounds into its tiny perforated cup, and fill the bottom container with water before putting it on a low flame. It's nearly 5 o'clock, and I won't be sleeping anymore. Was it the coffee that started things on their trajectory, or was it the Italian? All of a sudden, I feel cold and warm at the same time. He kept a hot plate in his office, one of those single-burner electric jobs you find in efficiency apartments and cheap motels. Tucked between it and his semantics texts was a tin of coffee, real coffee, not the ground-up dust they stocked the faculty kitchen with. We'd met to review the progress on lexical recall in my patients with anomia. For some reason, the anomics had me stumped. Their inability to conjure up the names of the most common objects while knowing exactly how to describe them had set my research back to ground zero. If I couldn't produce a positive report by the end of the month, I'd be saying goodbye to funding and sayonara to tenure. Lorenzo set the coffee to percolate, and we walked through the latest brain scans. There, among MRIs and EEGs and Italian coffee, it began. The first thing I noticed was his hand as it poured thick black espresso into a demitasse. His skin was dark, had none of the scrubbed pinkness of Patrick's hand. One of his nails was chipped, and there were calluses on the tips of his fingers, which were long and thin.
"You play the guitar?" I asked.
"Mandolin," he said. "And some guitar."
My father played the mandolin. My mother would sing along. We all would. Nothing great, just the usual folk songs. Torna a Suriento, Corna Grato, things like that. He laughed. What's funny?
An American family singing Corna Grato.
Now it was my turn to laugh. What makes you think I'm American? Only I didn't say it that way. I said it in Italian. We met like that in his office, where the hot plate and the little coffee maker were. Once I'd put the Anomia project to bed, thus securing my somewhat unstable future for another semester, we still met.
"I brought you a bit of Italy,"
he said one day, not long after he'd returned from visiting family over spring break. Our speech had migrated from half-English, half-Italian to full-throttle Neapolitan, and Lorenzo's office became an oasis of continentalisms. Café, music, the crunchy baked tarale cookies he brought in on Mondays after slaving all weekend over his grandmother's recipe. He pushed a newspaper-wrapped object across the desk. "What is it?" I asked.
"Some music for you, Jana. Open it."
I did. Inside the paper was a wooden box, inlaid and polished, a five-petaled rose motif around the border. It didn't look much like music until Lorenzo reached over and pushed up the cover with a finger. I still remember that, how he lifted the hinged top with such care, like a bridegroom sliding a lace skirt above his new wife's knee, preparing to hook his finger into her garter. A lascivious action, made tender by the gentleness. That was the first time I imagined Lorenzo's hand on my bare skin. An ordinary Monday in his book-cluttered office with the music box tinkling out Torna al Suriento and the espresso maker bubbling its thick, sweet coffee. Lorenzo isn't a believer, or a hater, or a coward. He's in his own category, tucked inside a dark and pleasant corner of my mind. 17. Stephen is the first to wake up and is out of the house before either Patrick or I start our morning routines. The twins, in a rare feat of self-sufficiency, if not color coordination, have dressed themselves and now pour the last of the milk into bowls laden with multicolored, teeth-rotting puffs of sugar. Leo has a sweater on inside out, and Sam fixes it. Neither of them says much over his cereal. "What happened last night was only an argument," I say.
"It's strange when you talk, Mom," Leo says.
I suppose it would be, after a year. By the time Patrick comes in, looking as if he's had less sleep than he has, the twins are on their way to the bus stop, and I'm dressing Sonia, sliding one thin arm at a time into her windbreaker. My hand lingers on her red bracelet, and she tugs her wrist away, her small hand slipping from my grasp.
"I'm sorry you had to see that yesterday, with Stephen."
She nods, as if she's sorry she had to see it too. We walk to the bus together, as quiet as we've been on all the other days of the school year. I have words now, but no idea how to use them, no clue how to make my daughter's life better, if only for a while.
"No more scary dreams, right?"
Sonia nods again. Of course, she wouldn't have had any nightmares last night. Not with the small dose of Somanex I stirred into her cocoa. Patrick still doesn't know about that, and I'm not sure I'll tell him.
"Be good in school," I say, and help her clamber up on the bus.
Be good in school. What a crock of shit. I imagine my daughter sitting behind a desk, one of that kind that has the cubby under the seat where books and bright Hello Kitty pencil cases, and later secret notes spelling, "Do you like Tommy? I think Tommy likes you," would hide. For mica laminated writing surfaces where you scratched hearts and initials, or where you traced the carvings of some other boy or girl in some other year, wondering if BL ever married KT, or if Mr. Pondergrass, the algebra teacher, really was a pig monster with eye boogers.
Black and white composition books, later thinner and bluer when the writing assignments shifted from What I Did During Summer Vacation to Compare and Contrast Shakespeare's Hamlet and Macbeth. All those things, simple and ordinary, that we assumed we would never lose. What do they study now, our girls? A bit of addition and subtraction, telling time, making change. Counting, of course. They would learn counting first, all the way up to 100. When Sonia entered first grade this past fall, the school held an open house. Patrick and I went, along with the rest of the parents. I never saw the announcement that was sent to the fathers, or grandfathers, in the event one of the girls was a Heather with two mommies. Of course, there aren't any two-mommy or two-daddy families anymore. The children of same-sex partnerships have all been moved to live with their closest male relative, an uncle, a grandfather, an older brother, until the biological parent remarries in the proper way. Funny, with all the talk before of conversion therapy and curing homosexuality, no one ever thought of the foolproof way of getting gays in line. Take away their kids. I suspect attendance at the open house that night was mandatory, although Patrick didn't say so, only urged me to go check out the facilities, which were supposed to be state-of-the-art. State-of-the-art what? I said, checking my counter before speaking. An hour later, we found out. There were still classrooms, complete with desks and projection screens. The bulletin boards were wallpapered with drawings. A family picnicking here, a man in a suit holding a briefcase there, a woman wearing a straw hat and planting a bed of purple flowers in another corner. Children on a school bus, girls playing with dolls, boys arranged in a baseball triangle. I didn't see any books, but of course I hadn't expected to. We didn't spend much time in the classrooms before teachers, each one wearing a small blue pea pin on his collar, marched us along the corridors for the tour. "Here's the sewing room," our group leader said, opening a set of double doors and motioning us inside. "Each girl, once she's old enough to work the machines without pulling a Sleeping Beauty," he laughed at his own joke, "will have her own digital singer. Really amazing equipment, these." He stroked one of the sewing machines as if it were a pet. "Now, if you'll follow me, we'll have a peek at the kitchens before heading outside to the gardening area." It was home ec on drugs, and not much more. I waved to Sonia as the bus pulls away from the curb. Today, she'll be in a room with 25 other first graders, all girls. She'll listen to stories, practice her numbers, help the older students in the kitchen as they cut cookies and knead dough and crimp pies. This is what school is now, and what school will be for some time. Maybe forever. Memory is a damnable faculty. I envy my only daughter. She has no recall of life before quotas or school days before the Pure movement took off. It's a struggle to remember the last time I saw a number greater than 40 on her fragile wrist, except, of course, for 2 nights ago, when I watched that number creep upward to 100. For the rest of us, for my former colleagues and students, for Lynn, for the book club ladies, and the woman who used to be my gynecologist, and Mrs. Ray, who will never landscape another garden, memory is all we have. There's no way I can win, but there's a way I can feel like a winner. In the minute it takes to walk back across the street and climb the steps to our porch, I decide. Patrick has the television on, and Reverend Carl is holding a press conference. The White House room looks much the same as it always did, except there are no women, only a sea of dark suits and power ties. All of the reporters nod as they listen to Reverend Carl's updates on Bobby Meyer's condition. "We have someone who can help," Carl says. A chorus of "Who?" and "Where did you find him?" and "Wonderful news!" rips through the press hall. Patrick interrupts his watching and turns to me.
"That's you, babe. Back in business."
But I don't want to be back in business. Not for Bobby Meyer's sake, or the president's sake, or the sake of any of the other men in that room. Reverend Carl does his usual double-handed press of the air in front of him as if he's deflating an air mattress, or squashing some weaker object.
"Now everyone listen up.
What we're doing is a little unconventional, a little radical even, but I'm sure Dr. Jean McClellan is the right person for the job. As many of you know, her work on the reversal of...
He checks his notes to get the technical wording right.
Fluent aphasia, also known as Wernicke's aphasia, was groundbreaking. Of course, that work has been on temporary hold until we get things sorted out, but I want to say...
I switch the TV off. I don't give a shit what Reverend Carl wants to say. I never will. I won't do it, I tell Patrick. So call Reverend Carl before you leave for work.
What am I supposed to say?
I look at my wrist, clear of its electrical burn, clear of its silver-toned collar. Tell him I said no.
Jean, please, you know what will happen if you don't agree.
Maybe it's the way he says this. Maybe it's the look in his eyes, that tired, beaten down like a disobedient puppy look. Maybe it's the sour smell of milk and coffee on his breath when he speaks. It might be a combination of all three, but at this moment, in the house where we conceived four children, I realize I don't love him anymore. I wonder if I ever did. 18. This time, Reverend Carl comes to the house alone. His suit is the same expensive coal gray wool of yesterday, but double-breasted instead of single. I count the buttons on it. 3 on the right, 3 on the left, 4 on each sleeve. The sleeve buttons are the kind that overlap by a few millimeters, kissing buttons, as my father called them when he had his haberdashery, the sign of a bespoke suit. Also, they're real working buttons, and Reverend Carl leaves each of the bottom ones undone. He wants the world to see what exquisite taste he has, I suppose. Lorenzo never showed off like this. Over coffee one afternoon, I think it was 2 winters ago, while we were plowing through another roadblock on the Wernicke project, I accidentally brushed his jacket sleeve with my pen, leaving a small but ugly mark on the gray material.
"Leave it," he said.
"Be right back." I kept a bottle of hairspray in my office in those days. By those days, I mean the days after Lorenzo and I started working together. I hadn't bothered before, usually content to let the dark curls that I inherited from my mother have their own unruly way. But that afternoon, I had a canister of Paul Mitchell Freeze and Shine lurking in a drawer along with a nail file, a pick, and an emergency makeup kit, just in case Lynn called any surprise project meetings. The things we girls do. After I sprayed and dabbed the ink mark, I ran a fingernail down the waterfall of 4 buttons. They clicked as I touched them. "Kissing buttons," I said.
"Haven't seen those in a while."
My father had told me they work sleeve buttons that way only in Italy. And so, that's how it happened. A stupid, offhand comment about a childhood memory, and Lorenzo's foot kicked the door shut as his mouth found mine. That was a nice place to be, but now I'm back in my living room with Patrick and Reverend Carl and Carl's sleeve buttons, the bottom one on each wrist undone.
"We were hoping, Dr. McClellan, that you would..."
Reverend Carl starts. He's staring longingly at my coffee mug. I don't offer him a drink of his own. I don't let him finish. Well, I won't.
"We could up the pay."
Patrick's eyes flash, first at Reverend Carl, then at me. "We'll make do," I say, and take another sip of coffee. I've grown used to defiance in small forms, like when I picked that blood-red counter for Sonia. There's no desperation in his voice, no pleading, only a slight turning up at the corners of his mouth when he says,
"What if I told you we had other incentives?"
Now I imagine myself in a room somewhere, a dirty and barren place with sound-attenuated walls and no windows, and with sweat-streaked, beady-eyed men who follow commands like, "Take it up a notch," and "Give her a moment to think it over," and "Let's start again." It's all I can do not to flinch, to hold a steady gaze.
"Such as?"
His smile broadens.
"We could, for instance, increase your daughter's quota. Let's say to 150? No, 200.
You can increase it to 10,000, Reverend. She's not talking as it is.
I'm sorry about that,
he says, but nothing in his tone indicates sorrow. This is what he wanted, docile women and girls. The older generations need to be controlled, but eventually, by the time Sonia has children of her own, Reverend Carl Corbin's dream of pure women and pure men will be the way of the world. I hate him for this. Anything else? I say. Patrick shoots me a look, but doesn't speak. Reverend Carl only takes a slim metal box from his pocket.
Then I'll have to put this back on.
The "this" he's referring to is the narrow black band inside the box. That's not mine, I say. Mine is silver. Another smile, but now Reverend Carl's eyes join in.
A new model, he says. You'll find it functions exactly as your former bracelet did, but this one has two additional features.
What, a built-in miniature bullwhip?
Jean,
Patrick says. I ignore him.
Nothing like that, Dr. McClellan. The first feature is a courtesy tracker.
A what?
We like to think of it as a gentle nudge, nothing more. Just keep things clean and everything will function normally. No four-letter words, no blasphemy. If you slip up, that's okay, but your quota reduces by 10 for each infraction. You'll get used to it.
I feel like Cartman in that South Park movie, the one where he gets a chip implanted in his head that shocks him every time he says fuck, which, because it's South Park, is effectively all the time.
The second requires a bit more action on your part.
He taps the red button at the side of the band.
Once a day, at a time of your choosing, you will press this button and speak into the bracelet. There's a microphone here.
He points to the other side, opposite the red button.
We're hoping this practice will help get people...
Women, I interrupt.
Yes, women. We're hoping it will help put you in the mood, understand the fundamentals.
How? From his breast pocket, he removes a folded sheet of paper and smooths it out. It's a typed list.
You'll read this once a day into the microphone. Press the red button twice before you start and twice when you've finished. It won't count against your quota.
What won't count? My mouth has gone dry. I take another swallow of coffee, now cold. He hands me the sheet.
Why don't you read it now while I train the device to your voice? We'll kill two birds with one stone that way.
The first words I read are in bold blue type at the top of the page. I believe that man was created in the image and glory of God, and that woman is the glory of the man, for man was not made of woman, but woman was made from man. I can't read this, I say. Reverend Carl checks his watch.
Dr. McClellan, I have a meeting downtown in an hour. If we can't finish this, I'll have to call someone who can.
I'm picturing Thomas of the dark suit and dark complexion and even darker eyes, the one who took my counter off yesterday morning, the man I saw once before, a year ago, when men first came for us. On the day I announced our team's progress to a packed seminar room, 2 dozen uniformed men, their left arms banded with the presidential seal, midnight black weapons in their right hands, pushed through the crowd. My projector dimmed in the time it took me to catch a breath. Behind me, only ghosts of my formulas remained on the white scrim. It had begun, the terrible, unthinkable thing Patrick had warned me about only days earlier. They separated our crowd, sending the men away, lining the rest of us up, and leading 50 students and faculty women, some tenured, some new, through empty hallways. Lynn was the first to voice her resistance. Thomas was on her like a cougar after prey, that midnight black torture stick of his now pointing menacingly at Lynn Kwan's petite frame. I watched her fold and bend and collapse on herself, wordlessly, only the thread of a pained sigh, high-pitched and taut, coming from her lips. 5 of us ran to the crumpled mass of woman on the tile floor, only to be beaten off. Those who lingered were also tased or stunned.
like misbehaving animals, cows, pets. None of this happened without a fight, is what I'm saying.
Dr. McClellan?
Reverend Carl has his phone out now, one long finger poised over the green send button, ready to tap and summon a man who is short on charm and long on persuasive techniques.
Fine. I'll read it,
I say, thinking I can speak these horrible words without letting them invade me. So I begin. By the time I'm halfway down the page, Patrick's skin has blanched to a paste color. Reverend Carl nods each time I speak one of the beliefs or affirmations or declarations of intent into the black bracelet. We are called as women to keep silence and to be under obedience. If we must learn, let us ask our husbands in the closeness of the home, for it is shameful that a woman question God-ordained male leadership. Nod. When we obey male leadership with humility and submission, we acknowledge that the head of every man is Christ and that the head of every woman is the man. Nod. God's plan for woman, whether married or single, is that she adorn herself with shamefacedness and sobriety, and that she exhibit modesty and femininity without fanciful or proud displays. Nod. I will seek to adorn myself inwardly and to be pure, modest, and submissive. In this way, I will glorify man, thereby glorifying God. Nod. I will honor the sanctity of marriage, both mine and that of others, for God will judge adulterers with vengeance. Nod. I hope Patrick interprets the break in my voice at this as a sign of discomfort. Reverend Carl nods once more when I'm finished with the page, and taps the red button twice.
Well done, Mrs. McClellan.
There's an emphasis on Mrs.
Patrick, will you do the honors?
Patrick shifts and sets his still full coffee cup on the end table, spilling it. Then he takes the black thing from Reverend Carl's hand, encircles my left wrist with it, and snaps it closed. So this is how I lose my voice for the second time, with a click that sounds like a bomb. 19. I think I've developed superhuman hearing. This afternoon, as I wait for Sonia's bus to snake along the lane toward our bungalow, I hear every sound. Not the sounds I used to hear. Not the CNN reporters droning politics from the mini television in the kitchen. Not John, Paul, George, and Ringo telling me through the stereo speakers they want to hold my hand. Not my own voice singing, badly, I'll admit, along. I hear the wet slap of the dough as I knead it into submission, the deafening hum of the refrigerator, the high-frequency whine of Patrick's computer through the locked door of his study. I hear my own heartbeat, steady, incessant. There's the motor now, the Doppler effect amping up the frequency as the bus approaches. Already I have my three words planned for when Sonia arrives. Mommy loves you. More may be said later, but this is enough for now. I place the dough in a large glass bowl for its second rise and towel off the flour that's stuck between my fingers. Should have taken off my ring, but I forgot. Then I force on a smile. Not too wide, not too clownish, I don't want it to look like a bad makeup job, and head for the door. Sonia leaps from the bus's steps, waves to Mr. Benjamin before he drives off toward his next drop-off point, and covers the 100 feet between bus stop and porch like an adrenaline-charged feline. Normally steady and deliberate, she's got a bounce in her this afternoon, a jitterbug type of anxiety. My girl is shiny with excitement as she leaps into my arms, the paper she's holding grazing my left ear, her downy cheek sticky and sweet with a glaze of chocolate. Mommy loves you, I say. Pulse, pulse, pulse. I've hardly registered my own words when she breaks the hug.
One prize!
Sonia squeals, thrusting the paper into my hands, pointing to her mouth, licking at it with a pink tongue. When I wrinkle my eyes at her, she makes three stabbing motions with her index finger at the smear of dried ice cream lingering at the corner of her mouth. I take her hand and move it away from her mouth, shaking my head. She forgets sometimes about the cameras. And Stephen.
Sonia points to her mouth again, desperate to make me see the chocolate smear, and again I press her hand down, holding her fingers in my fist. A few seconds of pointing or gesturing at home might not matter, unless it becomes a habit. A single, painful image of Sonia doing this in public flashes in front of me, or worse, in front of Steven, the goddamned spy kid. I squeeze her fingers a little more tightly while my other hand turns over the envelope she's brought home. On the front, there's a label, addressed to Dr. Patrick McClellan. And of course, the envelope is sealed. So, there we are. My three words of the day, unless you count the ingredients list on the bag of flour, and the green LED message, "Your beverage is ready," glowing from the microwave when I reheated my coffee. "Why?" I say, leading Sonia inside, trying to ignore the next pulse on my wrist. "Careful with your words." This is more conversation than we usually have, but I'm desperate to know what news my girls brought home. I'm also desperate to keep her from blurting out more than she should. I haven't yet checked the total on her counter. In the kitchen, while I fix a mug of cocoa for us, our silent afternoon ritual, Sonia hops onto a bar stool, thrusts out her left hand, and speaks one ear-splitting word.
"Lowest!"
What the hell? Then I read the counter on her red bracelet. They call them bracelets in school, at the doctor's office, in the advertisements they show before movies. I consider this as I wet a paper towel and wipe the smudge of chocolate, what I suspect is Sonia's prize, from her mouth, and watch her create a new mocha-colored mustache as she spoons hot cocoa from the mug. Advertisements for electric shock-inducing silencers. Pick your own color. Add some sparkles or stripes. They've got a mood ring type that will match your clothing if you're obsessive about being coordinated, a variety of ringtones, cartoon character designs for the younger set. It's everything I can do to keep from cursing the men who made these, or the marketers and their sinister efforts to persuade us we have any kind of choice. I suppose if things ever return to normal, they'll use that old chestnut of a line, "I was only following orders." Where have we heard that before? I can't be in this kitchen now. Can't watch my girl sip cocoa and study the white envelope on the counter as if it contained a fucking Congressional Medal of Honor. So I go somewhere else. I try to imagine her on the playground, skipping rope and playing alphabet games, singing "Miss Lucy Had a Steamboat," and giggling at the thinly veiled curse words. I see her lining up, whispering about the new boy in class, writing love notes and fortunes on paper she'll fold into cootie catchers. I hear her speak thousands of useless but precious words before the first bell rings. Another motor purrs, then growls, through the screen door of the back porch, and I'm out of my daydream. At least Patrick is home before the boys return from school. I don't have anything to say to him, but I need him alone. I need to see what secrets Sonia's mystery letter holds. But I don't, not really. Across the kitchen island, my daughter's counter glows its horrid and up to the second report. "One prize," she said. "Lowest." I know what her school is up to. I know because the counter on her thin wrist says the number 3. My daughter has been silent all day. 20. I was right. It is a contest. The letter Patrick opens and reads to me announces with great pleasure the launch of a monthly competition for all students enrolled at PGS 523. The PGS stands for Pure Girls School. Obviously, the boys attend PBS, Stephen at the high school, Sam and Leo in another for grades 5 through 8. They don't divide the girls this way, possibly as a method of fulfilling yet another pledge from the manifesto, that older women provide teaching and training to younger women, possibly because they don't want to double up on the number of digital sewing machines and garden equipment.
"They're doing daily contests first," Patrick says, settling onto the bar stool across from me after grabbing a beer from the fridge. It's early for him, but I don't say anything. "Ice cream for the girl in each grade with the lowest..." He takes a rather large swig from the bottle. "With the lowest number on her counter."
so it was exactly as I expected. He continues,
"At the end of the month, they'll tally all the counts and..."
"Words," I interrupt. The black band on my left wrist pulses once.
"Right. Words. There's a grade prize of what they're calling an age-appropriate gift. A doll for the younger girls, games for the middle graders, makeup for the over-16s.
Super. Trading voices for crap. The worst part is that Patrick is smiling.
"Enough of this," he says. "It doesn't matter."
"Like hell it doesn't." The contraption circling my wrist pings 4 times, and I watch the number tick up from 46 to 50. Then it emits a sound like a diseased frog, and the 50 becomes 60. Okay, hell is now out of my vocabulary. So much for George Carlin's list of 7 dirty words. I wish I knew why Patrick was beaming at me. As if he's read my mind, he leaves the kitchen, retrieves his briefcase from the front hall, and sets it on the counter dividing us.
"Present from the president, babe,"
he says as he removes an envelope from the leather case. In the upper right-hand corner is the presidential seal. In the left, where the return address would normally go, is a silver embossed capital P, the model for Stephen's new pin. And speak of the devil, the boys are home. Leo and Sam bound into the kitchen first, kiss me hello, and make a beeline for the snack drawer. Stephen, more composed than even he usually is, goes for the fridge after a curt, "Hi, Dad. Hi, Mom." He'll be looking for milk, which, of course, I forgot to buy.
"Nice,"
Stephen says, shaking the last teaspoon of milk in the carton. He seems surprised when I don't come back with a response, then sees the latest addition to my wardrobe.
"You got the new model. Awesome. Julia has one too, except hers is purple with silver stars. Just got it today. She showed me when I was walking home from the bus."
I don't hate my son. I don't hate my son. I don't hate my son. Except right now, I do. A little bit.
"Read the letter, Jean,"
Patrick says. President Myers was on television again today. He's always on television, it seems, always trumpeting a new plan to turn the country around, constantly telling us how much better off we are. The economy's up, but not in our household, as the broken air conditioning reminds me. Unemployment is down, as long as you don't count the 70 million women who lost their jobs. Everything's great and everything's fine. Everything wasn't so fine today as he fielded questions from the press.
"We'll find someone," he said. "Whatever it takes, we'll find someone to cure my only brother."
Like hell you will, I thought. The same slight smile on Anna Meyer's lips told me she thought it too. Good for you, sister. Even if I agreed, there were no guarantees of success. Wernicke's aphasia is a tricky devil. Maybe I'd have a chance if I could make sure Lin Kuan was actually on the team, and not just the backup Reverend Carl mentioned. Even better, Lin and Lorenzo. But I don't want to think about Lorenzo just now. I don't like to think about him when Patrick is around.
"You going to open it?"
Patrick says. I slide a nail under the flap of the envelope. Inside is a single trifold sheet of bond paper, off-white letterhead. It's addressed to me, Dr. Jean McClellan. So I'm back to doctor for the time being. The body of the letter is one sentence long.
"Well?"
Patrick asks the question, but his eyes tell me he already knows what the president has to say.
"Hang on."
He gets another beer from the fridge, but doesn't drink it with the same celebratory mood as he did the first bottle. This one is medicinal. Liquid anesthesia to get him through the wait while I remove myself from the kitchen with my yet unvoiced decision. Maybe he expected me to do backflips on the tile. I don't know. Anyway, it's too hot in here to think. The back garden, under Mrs. Ray's magnolia, is better. "Please call me with your price," the president says. It's rather pleasant to see that the bastard is begging. My price. My price is to turn back the clock, but that's not feasible. My price is to eradicate the pure movement from the ground up, like pulling weeds from what was once a lively garden.
My price is to see Reverend Carl Corbin and his flock hanged or torn to shreds by wild dogs or burnt to cinders in hell. The back door creaks open and slams shut, and I expect to see Patrick coming toward me, but it isn't him. It's Sonia. She's holding a sheet of pink construction paper, the same color as her lips. When she reaches me, she holds it out. For a 6-year-old, she's got some talent, and this drawing is among her better ones, in a way. The 6 figures actually resemble us. Patrick, Stephen, the twins, me, and Sonia. We're all standing in our garden, holding hands under a tree that's blooming with white stars. She's got the twins in matching outfits, and she's drawn something that looks more like a suitcase than a briefcase in Patrick's free hand. Stephen wears his new pin. My hair is pulled back into a ponytail. Around my wrist and Sonia's are bracelets, red for her and black for me. We're all smiling under a sun she's decorated with orange hearts. Beautiful, I say, taking the drawing. But I don't think it's beautiful. I think it's the ugliest fucking thing I've ever seen. Instead of standing next to Patrick, or even at the far end of the family line, bookending our kids, I'm 5th. After my husband, after Stephen, after the 11-year-old twins. And Sonia has made me smaller than everyone except for her. I manage a forced smile and take her into my lap, pressing her head against me so she can't see the tears that are welling up that I won't be able to contain. I think of Jackie and those last words she spoke in our crappy Georgetown apartment, the accusations and admonitions. Jackie was right. I was living in a bubble. I inflated it myself, one breath at a time. And so here we are. Me, my daughter, and the wrist counters that keep us in line. I wonder what Jackie would have to say about it. Probably something like, "Good work, Jean. You gassed up the car and drove it straight into hell. Enjoy the burn." Yeah, that's what she'd say. And she'd be right. I blot tears with my sleeve and set my face into a less crooked state before turning Sonia's tiny head toward me and planting a kiss on her cheek. Then I check my word counter. 63 words so far today. Plenty left for what I have to say to President Myers. 21. I can do this, I think. I can do it in fewer than the 37 words I've got left. In my head, I rehearse my half of the telephone conversation. I want 3 things, Mr. President. I want my daughter's counter removed. I want her excused from school. I'll teach her at home Friday through Monday. I want Lynn on the project full-time, not just backup. No need to mention any other names. Lorenzo will be back in Italy now anyway. Sonia and the boys are in the add-on rec room watching cartoons whose sound effects trickle all the way into the kitchen. It's cooler in there because of the window unit, and that leaves Patrick and me alone.
Go on, babe, he says after yelling to Stephen to turn the volume down. Make the call.
I've never dialed the White House before. Patrick's job there started after the wrist counters went on, and I have little reason to phone him at work unless all I want to do is engage in some telephonic heavy breathing. I don't. Not with Patrick. My fingers find the numbers and press each one, hovering over the last. I almost miss it and dial a 5 instead of a 4. That's how badly my hands are shaking. A voice answers, not of a secretary or any other gatekeeper, but his, and I speak my 36 words.
I'm sorry, Dr. McClellan, but I can't do that.
Except these aren't the words he says in his gruff voice, a voice I sometimes think is unnatural in its harshness, because I suspect the president is, at heart, a weak and insecure excuse for a man. I suspect they all are. What he says, after a slight pause, is,
"Very well, Dr. McClellan."
And he ends the call.
Wow,
Patrick says. He's been close to me, breathing beer-scented air into my nostrils as he listened in. He seems shocked. A moment later, the phone rings. Patrick answers it with a cheery, "Hello," and says single words.
"Yes, fine.
Okay.
I have no idea what he's agreeing to.
Thomas will be here in a half hour, he says, to take off the,
don't you dare call them bracelets.
Counters,
he says. I nod and take out two boxes of pasta for dinner. Tomorrow, I've already decided it's going to be steak, a mountain of steak. We haven't been eating much of it lately. While I'm squeezing peeled tomatoes into a pot for sauce, I think about Sonia, how in less than 30 minutes she'll be free of that metaphorical collar, free to sing and chatter and answer questions that involve more than a nod or a shake of her head. What I don't know is how she'll greet this freedom. In college, before I switched gears and plunged headlong into the black hole of neuroscience and linguistic processing, I'd studied psychology. Behavioral, child, abnormal, and all of that. Now, staring into this pot of tomato mush and garlic, I'm thinking I did a crackerjack job on the behavioral part, conditioning Sonia with bribes of cookies and marshmallows to keep her words unspoken. Someone should take away my mothering license. I keep reminding myself it isn't my fault. I didn't vote for Myers. I didn't vote at all, actually. And here is Jackie's voice again, telling me what an acquiescent shit I am. You have to vote, Jean, she said, throwing down the stack of campaign leaflets she'd been running around campus with while I was prepping for what I knew would be a monster of an oral exam. You have to. The only things I have to do are pay taxes and die, I said, not holding back the sneer in my voice. That semester was the beginning of the end for Jackie and me. I'd started dating Patrick and preferred our nightly discussions about cognitive processes to Jackie's rants about whatever new thing she had found to protest. Patrick was safe and quiet, and he let me bury myself in my work while he crammed for one medical school exam after another. Naturally, Jackie hated him. He's a pussy, Jean, a cerebral pussy. He's nice, I said. I bet he quotes from Grey's Anatomy while he's eating you out. I put my notes to the side. The book or the television show? This time, Jackie sneered. He doesn't talk politics, Jacko. It was my pet name for her, or had been. That's all I hear in this fucking city. One day, hun, you're going to change your mind. She tossed a paperback onto our thrift shop sofa, which I'd spread out on. Read this. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone. I picked up the book. It's a novel. You know I don't read novels. It was true. With 500 pages of journal articles a week, I had no time for fiction. Just read the back cover. I did. This would never happen. Ever. Women wouldn't put up with it. Easy to say now, Jackie said. She was in her usual outfit. Low-rise jeans, a cropped t-shirt that didn't cover her belly, which Jackie didn't care to hide, even with its slight paunch, ugly but comfortable sandals, and three hoops in her right ear. Today, her cropped and spiked hair had a few green streaks in it. Tomorrow it might be blue, or black, or cherry cola red. You really never knew with Jackie. She wasn't unattractive, but that square jaw and sharp nose and oil-drop eyes of hers didn't have guys banging down our door for her company. Jackie didn't seem to mind, and I found out why one night in September after she dragged me to a party. It was less of a party than a Planned Parenthood commercial with snacks and booze, both of which Jackie sucked down as if Armageddon were set for tomorrow morning. We didn't have a lot of spare change for liquor and junk food, although Jackie always managed to find a few bucks to keep her in cigarettes. Christ, she was drunk. I ended up having to half-carry her back through cobblestone streets to the apartment. No small trick when the person you're carrying is trying to chain-smoke. Love you, Jeannie, she said when I finally got her through the door. Love you too, Jacko, I said automatically. Want a cup of tea or something? We didn't have any tea, so I popped open a can of Coke and tried to feed her a few aspirin. I want a kiss, she said after she'd fallen onto her bed, taking me with her. She smelled of patchouli and red wine. Come here, Jeannie. Kiss me. What Jackie wanted wasn't a kiss. It was full-on spit-swapping. The next day over coffee, she laughed it off.
Sorry if I got a little crazy last night, hon. I never told Patrick about that.
What you thinking about, babe?
Patrick says, startling me and sending a peeled Roma tomato squirting against the backsplash.